genes. The heart monitor was functioning perfectly well, but it couldn't substitute for the insight of a human being with a simple stethoscope. These medical lessons are not particularly useful to people who don't work in healthcare, but the story is inspiring to everyone. It's a story about a woman who stuck to her guns, despite implicit pressure to conform to the group's opinion. It's an underdog story. In the hierarchical hospital environment, it was the nurse who told the chief neonatologist the right diagnosis. A life hinged on her willingness to step out of her proper place. The story's power, then, is twofold. It provides simulation, knowledge about how to act, and inspiration, motivation to act. Note that both benefits, simulation and inspiration, are geared to generating action. In the last few chapters, we've seen that a credible idea makes people believe, an emotional idea makes people care, and in this chapter, we'll see that the right stories make people act. Shop talk in the Xerox lunchroom. Photocopiers are perhaps the most complex machines that most of us will ever use. What other everyday machine combines optical, mechanical, chemical, and electrical technologies? It's a wonder copiers work at all, and often they don't. When there's a problem, and it's not one that a cubicle dweller can fix by opening and shutting the paper tray a few times, it takes a very sophisticated repair person to troubleshoot the situation. Researcher Julian Orr spent a lot of time among Xerox copier repairmen and found that they spend a lot of time swapping stories. Take the story below, which was told by a Xerox copier salesperson over a game of cribbage at lunch. We provided some explanatory comments. The salesperson starts with a reference to a recent mechanical change made by copier designers in an attempt to prevent an ordinary power surge from frying multiple components. The new XDR board configuration won't cook the board if you had an arcing dichrotron. Instead, it now trips the 24-volt interlock on the low-voltage power supply, and the machine will crash. But when it comes back up, it'll give you an EO53 error. This is a misleading error code that refers to an area of the machine that is unrelated to the real problem. That's exactly what I had down there at the end of the hall, and Weber and I ran for 4 hours trying to chase that thing. All it was a bad dichrotron. We finally got it running long enough, so we got an EO53 with an FO66, and the minute we checked the dichrotrons, we had one that was totally dead. Orr reports that there was a long pause for cribbage. Yeah, that was a fun one. These cribbage-playing guys in the lunchroom are simply talking shop, as we all do. A misleading EO53 error may not constitute drama in your world, but no doubt we all have our equivalents. Why do people talk shop? Part of the reason is simply humanity 101. We want to talk to other people about the things that we have in common. Xerox repairmen work with photocopiers, so they talk about them. But that's not the only factor at play here. For example, the storyteller above could have shared the general arc of the story without the details. I had a real bear of a problem today. It took me 4 hours to get to the bottom of it. I'm glad that one's over. Or he could have leapt straight to the punchline. After hours of hassle, I traced the problem back to the measly burned-out dichrotron. How was your morning? Instead, he tells a story that's much more interesting to his lunch partners. It has built-in drama. A misleading code leads two men on a wild goose chase until they uncover, through lots of work and thought, that the problem is simpler than they initially thought. Why is this story format more interesting? Because it allows his lunch partners to play along. He's giving them enough information so that they can mentally test out how they would have handled the situation. The people in the room who weren't aware of the misleading EO53 code have now had their EO53 schema fixed. Before, there was only one way to respond to an EO53 code. Now repairmen know to be aware of the misleading EO53 scenario. In other words, this story is part entertainment and part instruction. Shop talk conveys important clues about how to respond to the world. It teaches nurses not to have blind faith in heart monitors. It teaches copy repairmen to be aware of the misleading EO53 code. But the stories above aren't simply transferring nuggets of information. The Xerox story is not functionally equivalent to an email sent around the company that contains the line, "Watch out for false EO53 codes related to burned-out dichrotrons." Something more profound is happening here. It will take a bit of unpacking to reveal the additional value that these stories bring. The unpassive audience. Stories are strongly associated with entertainment, movies and books and TV shows and magazines. When children say, "Tell me a story," they're begging for entertainment, not instruction. Being the audience for a story seems like a passive role. Audiences who get their stories from television are called couch potatoes, after all. But passive may be overstating the case. When we read books, we have the sensation of being drawn into the author's world. When friends tell us stories, we instinctively empathize. When we watch movies, we identify with the protagonists. But what if stories involve us in less intuitive, more dramatic ways? One team of researchers has produced some exciting evidence suggesting that the line between a story's audience and a story's protagonist may be a bit blurry. Three psychologists interested in how people come to understand stories created a few for their study participants to read on a computer. They divided the participants into two groups. The first group read a story in which a critical object was associated with the main character in the story. For instance, John put on his sweatshirt before he went jogging. The second group read a story in which the same critical object was separated from the main character. John took off his sweatshirt before jogging. Two sentences later, the story threw in a reference to the sweatshirt, and the computer was able to track how long it took people to read that sentence. Something strange happened. The people who thought John had taken off his sweatshirt before the jog took more time to read the sentence than the people who thought John had it on. The result is subtle but fascinating. It implies that we create a kind of geographic simulation of the stories we hear. It's one thing to say, reading stories makes us see pictures in our head. We'd all find that statement intuitive. It's quite another thing to say that when John left his sweatshirt behind, he left it back at the house in a more remote place in our heads. For that to be true, we cannot simply visualize the story on a movie screen in our heads. We must somehow simulate it, complete with some analog, however loose, to the spatial relationships described in the story. These studies suggest that there's no such thing as a passive audience. When we hear a story, our minds move from room to room. When we hear a story, we simulate it. But what good is simulation? A group of UCLA students were asked to think about a current problem in their lives, one that was stressing them out, but was potentially solvable in the future, such as a problem with schoolwork or with a relationship. The students were told that the goal of the experiment was to help them deal with the problem effectively, and they got some brief instructions on problem solving. It is important to think about the problem, learn more about it, think about what you can do, take steps to deal with it. Resolving it could reduce your stress, make you feel pleased with how you dealt with it, and help you grow from the experience. After receiving these instructions, this control group was sent home and asked to report back to the lab a week later. A second group of students, the event simulation group, were kept in the lab. They were asked to mentally simulate how the problem had unfolded. "We would like you to visualize how this problem arose. Visualize the beginning of the problem, going over in detail the first incident. Go over the incidents as they occurred step by step. Visualize the actions you took. Remember what you said, what you did. Visualize the environment, who was around, where you were." The event simulation participants had to retrace, step by step, the events that led to their problem. Presumably, reviewing the chain of causation might help the students think about how to fix the problem, like programmers engaged in systematic debugging. A third group, the outcome simulation group, was asked to mentally simulate a positive outcome emerging from the problem. Picture this problem beginning to resolve. You are coming out of the stressful situation. Picture the relief you feel. Visualize the satisfaction you would feel at having dealt with the problem. Picture the confidence you feel in yourself, knowing that you have dealt successfully with the problem. The outcome simulators kept their focus on the desired future outcome. What will it be like once this problem is behind me? After this initial exercise, both of the simulation groups were sent home. Both groups were asked to spend 5 minutes every day repeating their simulations and to report back to the lab a week later. Now, it's play at home time. Make a quick prediction about which group of students fared best in coping with their problems. Hint, it's not the control group. Here's the answer. The event simulation group, the people who simulated how the events unfolded, did better on almost every dimension. Simulating past events is much more helpful than simulating future outcomes. In fact, the gap between the groups opened up immediately after the first session in the lab. By the first night, the event simulation people were already experiencing a positive mood boost compared with the other two groups. When the groups returned a week later, the event simulator's advantage had grown wider. They were more likely to have taken specific action to solve their problems. They were more likely to have sought advice and support from others. They were more likely to report that they had learned something and grown. You may find these results a bit counterintuitive because the pop psychology literature is full of gurus urging you to visualize success. It turns out that a positive mental attitude isn't quite enough to get the job done. Maybe financial gurus shouldn't be telling us to imagine that we're filthy rich. Instead, they should be telling us to replay the steps that led to our being poor. Why does mental simulation work? It works because we can't imagine events or sequences without evoking the same modules of the brain that are evoked in real physical activity. Brain scans show that when people imagine a flashing light, they activate the visual area of the brain. When they imagine someone tapping on their skin, they activate tactile areas of the brain. The activity of mental simulation is not limited to the insides of our heads. People who imagine words that start with B or P can't resist subtle lip movements. And people who imagine looking at the Eiffel Tower can't resist moving their eyes upward. Mental simulation can even alter visceral physical responses. When people drink water but imagine that it's lemon juice, they salivate more. Even more surprisingly, when people drink lemon juice but imagine that it's water, they salivate less. Mental simulations help us manage emotions. There is a standard treatment for phobias of various kinds. Spiders, public speaking, airplane travel, and others. Patients are introduced to a relaxation procedure that inhibits anxiety and then asked to visualize exposure to the thing they fear. The first visualization started the periphery of the fear. For example, someone who's afraid of air travel might start by thinking about the drive to the airport. The therapist leads the patient through a series of visualizations that get closer and closer to the heart of the fear. Now the airplane's engines are revving up on the runway, sounding louder and louder. Each time the visualizations create anxiety, the person pauses for a moment and uses the relaxation technique to restore equilibrium. Notice that these visualizations focus on the events themselves, the process, rather than the outcomes. No one has ever been cured of a phobia by imagining how happy they'll be when it's gone. Mental simulation helps with problem solving. Even in mundane planning situations, mentally simulating an event helps us think of things that we might otherwise have neglected. Imagining a trip to the grocery store reminds us that we could drop off the dry cleaning at the store in the same shopping center. Mental simulations help us anticipate appropriate responses to future situations. Picturing a potential argument with our boss, imagining what she will say, may lead us to have the right words available when the time comes and avoid saying the wrong words. Research has suggested that mental rehearsal can prevent people from relapsing into bad habits such as smoking, excessive drinking, or overeating. A man trying to kick a drinking problem will be better off if he mentally rehearses how he will handle Super Bowl Sunday. How should he respond when someone gets up for beers? Perhaps most surprisingly, mental simulation can also build skills. A review of 35 studies featuring 3,214 participants showed that mental practice alone, sitting quietly, without moving, and picturing yourself performing a task successfully from start to finish, improves performance significantly. The results were borne out over a large number of tasks. Mental simulation helped people weld better and throw darts better. Trombonists improved their playing, and competitive figure skaters improved their skating. Not surprisingly, mental practice is more effective when a task involves more mental activity, e.g. trombone playing, as opposed to physical activity, e.g. balancing. But the magnitude of gains from mental practice is large on average. Overall, mental practice alone produced about two-thirds of the benefits of actual physical practice. The takeaway is simple. Mental simulation is not as good as actually doing something, but it's the next best thing. And to circle back to the world of sticky ideas, what we're suggesting is that the right kind of story is, effectively, a simulation. Stories are like flight simulators for the brain. Hearing the nurse's heart monitor story isn't like being there, but it's the next best thing. Or think about the Xerox EO53 code story. Why is hearing this story better than a warning about misleading EO53 indicators in the training manual? It's better for precisely the reason that flight simulators are better for pilots than stacks of instructional flashcards. The more that training simulates the actions we must take in the world, the more effective it will be. A story is powerful because it provides the context missing from abstract prose. It's back to the Velcro theory of memory. The idea that the more hooks we put into our ideas, the better they'll stick. The EO53 story builds in emotions. The frustration of failing to find the problem and being misled by the machine's code. It builds in historical background. The idea that the recent change in the XER board configuration led to this new error. At the end, it delivers a kind of meta-level moral. You shouldn't have complete faith in the error code. This code skepticism is something the repairman can apply to every future job they undertake. It's easy for a doctor to treat appendicitis once it's been diagnosed, but the problem is learning to distinguish an inflamed appendix from an upset stomach or food poisoning or an ulcer. Or think about beginning algebra students who can solve complex equations but grind to a halt when they're presented with a simple word problem that involves exactly the same math. Problem X doesn't always identify itself as problem X. This is the role that stories play, putting knowledge into a framework that is more lifelike, more true to our day-to-day existence, more like a flight simulator. Being the audience for a story isn't so passive after all. Inside, we're getting ready to act. Clinic, dealing with problem students. The situation. Professors have to deal with the occasional nuisance in class, an angry, aggressive, or challenging student. Many professors are caught by surprise and aren't sure how to deal with the situation. In this clinic, we'll compare two different messages that were intended to share strategies for coping with these students. Message 1. The first message was produced by Indiana University as a resource for instructors. Remain calm. Slow down and regularize your breathing. Don't become defensive. Don't ignore them. Attempt to diffuse their anger. Arrange to meet them during a break or after class. During the meeting, acknowledge the student's emotions and listen. Talk in a professional and courteous manner. Comments on message 1. Notice that there's nothing unexpected here, nothing that is uncommon sense. And if dealing with difficult students is common sense, then why do we need to publish tips for dealing with them? Most of the advice, remain calm, don't become defensive, attempt to diffuse their anger, is both too abstract and too obvious to stick. Few teachers believe that you should freak out in response to a problem student. Message 2. The second message was posted informally to a news group by a professor named Allison Buckman, who wanted to share her experience with other teachers in the group. I had a student who talked loudly and often in the back of the class, generally when I was speaking. I could hear his comments at the front of the room, and so could everyone else. He also disagreed with me on every point I made, no matter what it was. Students began very quickly to complain about his behavior in their journals and suggest methods, generally designed to humiliate, of dealing with him. I tried several things from the beginning, but finally called he and his confidant in class up to the front at the end of the class one day and scheduled appointments with me in my office. I made sure I had witnesses to these appointments as well, one of the perks of being in a shared office space. The confidant, I believe, had been trapped into that role. The other student just utilized his body as a means to disruption. When I met with the bully, he came in with sunglasses on and a totally defiant behavior. I started with, "Why don't you tell me what's going on in the back of the room?" And he responded, "I disagree with you." I attempted to talk about this and met with silence. It was not until I told him that other students were complaining and suggesting treatments for the situation that he listened. His body language totally changed, as did his manner. I didn't have a problem with him from then on. My basic understanding of this little teaching lesson was that students who display contempt for the teacher might very well be brought into check by other students. After all, he thought he was showing off for them, and found that they didn't want to hear or see it. Comments on Message 2. This story allows us to simulate the process of dealing with a problem student. We follow along with Buckman as she works her way through the problem. Notice that many of the bulleted points from the first message are shown rather than told in the story. The professor attempts to diffuse the student's anger. She arranges to talk with the student in a more private setting. She stays calm throughout. The solution, in essence, using peer pressure to get the student under control, is both concrete and unexpected. It's uncommon sense. We might have expected a problem student not to care about what his peers thought. We empathize with Buckman, which makes us care about the outcome. It's easier to care about a person than a list of bulleted instructions. Punchline. A few stories like Professor Buckman's, flight simulators for reining in problem students, would be much more interesting and effective in training professors than the list of bullet points in Message 1. This solution is not intuitive. 9 out of 10 training departments would create Message 1. We must fight the temptation to skip directly to the tips and leave out the story. Stories as Inspiration. The Tale of Jared. In the late 1990s, the fast food giant Subway launched a campaign to tout the healthiness of a new line of sandwiches. The campaign was based on a statistic. 7 subs under 6 grams of fat. As far as statistics go, that's pretty good. A spoonful of alliteration helps the medicine go down. But 7 under 6 didn't stick like Subway's next campaign, which focused on the remarkable story of a college student named Jared Fogel. Jared had a serious weight problem. By his junior year in college, he had ballooned to 425 pounds. He wore size XXXXXXL shirts, the largest size available in big and tall clothing stores. His pants had a 60-inch waist. Jared's father, a general practitioner in Indianapolis, had been warning his son about his weight for years without much success. Then one day in December, Jared's roommate, a pre-med major, noticed that Jared's ankles were swollen. He correctly diagnosed edema, a condition in which the body retains fluid because the blood can't transport enough liquid. It often leads to diabetes, heart problems, and even early heart attacks. Jared's father told him that, given his weight and general health, he might not live past 35. By the spring break following his December hospital visit, Jared had decided to slim down. Motivated by the 7-under-6 campaign, he had his first turkey club. He liked the sandwich, and eventually he developed his own all-Subway diet, a foot-long veggie sub for lunch and a 6-inch turkey sub for dinner. After 3 months of the Subway diet, as he called it, he stepped on the scale. It read 330 pounds. He had dropped almost 100 pounds in 3 months by eating at Subway. He stuck with the diet for several more months, sometimes losing as much as a pound a day. As soon as his health permitted, he began walking as much as he could, not taking the bus to classes, and even walking upstairs rather than taking the department store escalator. The story of how Jared's inspiring weight loss became a national phenomenon begins with an article that appeared in the Indiana Daily Student in April 1999. It was written by Ryan Coleman, a former dorm mate of Jared's. Coleman saw Jared after he had lost weight and almost didn't recognize him. He wrote movingly about what it was like for Jared to be obese. When Fogel registered for a class, he didn't base his choice on professor or class time like most students. He based which classes to register on whether he could fit into the classroom seats. When most folks worried whether they could find a parking spot close to campus, Fogel worried whether he could find a parking spot without a car already parked nearby. He needed the extra room in order to open the driver's side door so he could get out. The article ended with this quote from Jared. "Subway helped save my life and start over. I can't ever repay that." This may have been the first time that a fast food chain was credited with transforming someone's life in a profoundly positive way. Then a reporter at Men's Health magazine, who was writing an article called "Crazy Diets That Work," happened to see the Indiana Daily article about Jared, and he included a blurb about a Subway sandwich diet. The article didn't mention Jared's name or even where he had bought the sandwiches. It simply referred generically to Subway sandwiches. The key link in the chain was a Subway franchise owner named Bob Osvia, who spotted the article and thought it had potential. He took time out of his schedule to track down the creative director at Subway's Chicago ad agency, a man named Richard Code, and suggested that he check out the article. Code says, "I kind of laughed at first, but we followed up on it." Jared is the hero of the weight loss story, but Osvia and Code are the heroes of our idea story. Osvia is a hero for spotting potential in a story, and Code is a hero for spending the resources to follow up on it. Code and Barry Krause, the president of the advertising agency called Hal Riney, sent an intern to Bloomington, Indiana, with vague instructions to find the mystery sandwich diet guy, and also to find out whose sandwiches he had been eating. It could easily have turned out that Jared had been dining at Flo's sub shop. The intern wasn't exactly sure what he was supposed to do. His tentative plan was to show up in Bloomington, look through the yellow pages, and start dropping by the town's sub shops. Fortunately for the intern, the operation never became that complex. The first sub shop the intern visited was a Subway franchise close to the campus. He launched into his description of the mystery eater, and about one sentence into the description, the counter worker said, "Oh, that's Jared. He comes here every day." The intern returned victorious. Jared was real, and he'd shed pounds by eating at Subway. The agency thought, "We've got a great story on our hands." And that's when the Jared story hit another hurdle. Ad agency president Krause called Subway's marketing director to unveil the tale of Jared, but the marketing director wasn't impressed. He had just started his job at Subway, having previously worked for another fast food company. "I've seen that before," he said. "Fast foods can't do healthy." The marketing director preferred to launch a campaign focused on the taste of Subway's sandwiches. To satisfy Krause, though, the director ran the Jared campaign idea by Subway's lawyers. The lawyers, predictably, said a Jared campaign couldn't be done. It would appear to be making a medical claim that might create a liability, blah, blah, blah. The only way to avoid any liability was to run disclaimers like, "We don't recommend this diet. See your doctor first." The idea seemed dead, but Krause and Code weren't ready to give up. Subway, like many franchise-based firms, runs ad campaigns at two levels, national and regional. While the national Subway office had vetoed Jared, some regional Subway franchisees expressed interest in the story and were willing to run the ads using regional advertising money. Then came another hurdle. Franchisees didn't usually pay to make the actual commercials. They just paid to run the commercials in their regions. The commercials were generally funded by the national office. So, who would pay for the Jared commercials? Krauss decided to make the spots for free. He said, "For the first and only time in my career, I gave the go-ahead to shoot an ad that we weren't going to be paid for." The ad first ran on January 1st, 2000, just in time for the annual epidemic of diet-related New Year's resolutions. It showed Jared in front of his home. "This is Jared," the announcer said. "He used to weigh 425 pounds. We see a photo of Jared in his old 60-inch waist pants. But today he weighs 180, thanks to what he calls the Subway diet." The announcer describes Jared's meal plan, then concludes, "That, combined with a lot of walking, worked for Jared. We're not saying this is for everyone. You should check with your doctor before starting any diet program, but it worked for Jared." The next day, Krauss said, the phone started ringing in the morning and didn't let up. USA Today called. ABC and Fox News called. On the third day, Oprah called. "I've talked to a lot of marketers over the years who wanted to get media attention," Krauss said. "No one ever got anywhere by lavishing calls on Oprah. The only time I've succeeded in my career with Oprah was with Jared, and Oprah called us." A few days later, Subway's national office called Krauss, asking if the ad could be aired nationally. In 1999, Subway's sales were flat. In 2000, sales jumped 18%, and they jumped another 16% in 2001. At the time, other much smaller sandwich chains, such as Slotsky's and Quiznos, were growing at about 7% a year. The Jared story has a morsel of simulation value. It makes it relatively easy to imagine what it would be like to embrace the Subway diet. The lunch order, the dinner order, the walking in between. But this story is not so much a flight simulator as it is a pep talk. This huge guy lost 245 pounds on a diet that he invented. Wow! The story provides a good kick in the pants for anyone who's been struggling to lose that last 10 pounds. Like the nurse story that opened the chapter, this story, too, has emotional resonance. Even skinny people who aren't interested in dieting will be inspired by Jared's tale. He fought big odds and prevailed through perseverance. And this is the second major payoff that stories provide. Inspiration. Inspiration drives action, as does simulation. By the way, note how much better this campaign functions than the 7 under 6 campaign. Both campaigns are mining the same turf. They both highlight the availability of nutritious, low-fat sandwiches. They both hold out the promise of weight loss. But one campaign was a modest success, and one was a sensation. What we have argued in this book, and we hope we've made you a believer by now, is that you could have predicted in advance that Jared would be the winner in these two campaigns. Note how well the Jared story does on the success checklist. It's simple. Eat subs and lose weight. It may be oversimplified, frankly, since the meatball sub with extra mayo won't help you lose weight. It's unexpected. A guy lost a ton of weight by eating fast food. This story violates our schema of fast food, a schema that's more consistent with a picture of a fat Jared than a skinny Jared. It's concrete. Think of the oversized pants, the massive loss of girth, the diet composed of particular sandwiches. It's much more like an Aesop fable than an abstraction. It's credible. It has the same kind of anti-authority truthfulness that we saw with the Pam Laffin anti-smoking campaign. The guy who wore 60-inch pants is giving us diet advice. It's emotional. We care more about an individual, Jared, than about a mass. And it taps into profound areas of Maslow's hierarchy. It's about a guy who reached his potential with the help of a sub shop. It's a story. Our protagonist overcomes big odds to triumph. it inspires the rest of us to do the same. By contrast, let's size up 7 under 6 on the checklist. It's simple, but notice that it has a much less compelling core message. Its core message is, we've got a variety of low-fat sandwiches, versus Jared's, eat Subway, lose weight, change your life. The first message sells drill bits. The second tells you how to hang your kid's picture. 7 under 6 is far less unexpected. Jared's story packs a wallop because it violates the powerful schema that fast food is fatty. If 7 under 6 is attacking the same schema, it makes the point much more tangentially. 7 under 6 isn't concrete. Numbers aren't concrete. It's credible only because it hasn't set the bar very high. Not many of us will be floored to hear that a sandwich has less than 6 grams of fat, so we don't need much convincing. It's not emotional, and it's not a story. Any reader of this book could have analyzed these two multi-million-dollar national ad campaigns and chosen the right one just by laying them side by side on the success checklist. Note, though, that non-readers might not be so savvy. The national advertising director, who had a lifetime of experience in trying to make ideas stick, wanted to walk away from the Jared story. Another compelling aspect of the Jared tale is how many people had to work hard to make it a reality. Look at how many unlikely events had to take place in order for Jared to hit TV. The Subway store manager had to be proactive enough to bring the magazine article to the creative director's attention. Would your frontline people do this? The creative director had to be savvy enough to invest resources in what could have been a fruitless errand. Was this really an errand with a good return on investment? The president of the ad agency had to make the spot for free because he knew he was onto something big. Free. The national Subway marketing team had to swallow its pride and realize that it had made a mistake by not embracing Jared earlier. These are not trivial actions. This behavior is not routine. How many great ideas have been extinguished because someone in the middle, a link between the source of the idea and its eventual outlet, dropped the ball? In the normal world, a franchise owner would have been amused by the Jared tale. He would have tacked it up on the bulletin board, on the wall of the hallway leading to the bathroom, as a source of amusement for his employees. And that would have been the pinnacle of the Jared tale. Jared reminds us that we don't always have to create sticky ideas. Spotting them is often easier and more useful. What if history teachers were diligent about sharing teaching methods that worked brilliantly in reaching students? What if we could count on the volunteers of nonprofit organizations to be on the lookout for symbolic events or encounters that might inspire other people in the organization? What if we could count on our bosses to take a gamble on important ideas? You don't have to admire Subway sandwiches to admire the process of bringing a great idea to life. The art of spotting. How do we make sure that we don't let a great idea, a potential Jared, float right under our nose? Spotting isn't hard, but it isn't natural either. Ideas don't flag themselves to get our attention. We have to consciously look for the right ones. So, what is it exactly that we should look for? In the introduction of the book, we discussed a study showing that laypeople, who'd been trained to use classic ad templates, could create ads that were vastly superior to those developed by an untrained group. Just as there are ad templates that have been proven effective, so too there are story templates that have been proven effective. Learning the templates gives our spotting ability a huge boost. Warren Buffett likes to tell the story of Rose Blumkin, a woman who manages one of the businesses that he invested in. Blumkin is a Russian woman who, at age 23, finagled her way past a border guard to come to America. She couldn't speak English and had received no formal schooling. Blumkin started a furniture business in 1937 with $500 that she had saved. Almost 50 years later, her furniture store was doing $100 million in annual revenue. At age 100, She was still on the floor 7 days a week. She actually postponed her 100th birthday party until an evening when the store was closed. At one point, her competitors sued her for violating the fair trade agreement because her prices were so much lower. They thought she was selling at a loss in order to put them out of business. Buffett says, "She demonstrated to the court that she could profitably sell carpet at a huge discount and sold the judge $1,400 worth of carpet." The story of Rose Blumkin isn't from the book Chicken Soup for the Soul, but it could be. The Chicken Soup series has become a publishing phenomenon, with more than 4.3 million books sold and 37 Chicken Soup titles in print, including Chicken Soup for the Father's Soul, Chicken Soup for the Nurse's Soul, and Chicken Soup for the NASCAR Soul. The Chicken Soup books traffic in inspirational stories, stories that uplift, motivate, energize. In that sense, these stories are the opposite of urban legends, which tend to reinforce a cynical, pessimistic, or paranoid view of the world. Strangers will steal your kidneys. Snapple supports the KKK. McDonald's puts worms in its burgers. What's amazing about these stories is that the authors didn't write them, they merely spotted and collected them. We wanted to understand what made these inspirational stories tick. We pored over inspirational stories, hundreds of stories, both from Chicken Soup and elsewhere, looking for underlying similarities. Aristotle believed there were four primary dramatic plots: simple tragic, simple fortunate, complex tragic, and complex fortunate. Robert McKee, the screenwriting guru, lists 25 types of stories in his book: the modern epic, the disillusionment plot, and so on. When we finished sorting through a big pile of inspirational stories, a much narrower domain, we came to the conclusion that there are three basic plots: the challenge plot, the connection plot, and the creativity plot. These three basic plots can be used to classify more than 80% of the stories that appear in the original Chicken Soup collection. Perhaps more surprisingly, they can also be used to classify more than 60% of the stories published by People magazine about people who aren't celebrities. If an average person makes it into People, it's usually because he or she has an inspiring story for the rest of us. If our goal is to energize and inspire others, these three plots are the right place to start. By the way, if you're a more jaded type of person who finds the Chicken Soup series treacly rather than inspirational, you'll still find value in the three plot templates. You can always turn down the volume on the plots a bit. The challenge plot. The story of David and Goliath is the classic challenge plot. A protagonist overcomes a formidable challenge and succeeds. David fells a giant with his homemade slingshot. There are variations of the challenge plot that we all recognize: the underdog story, the rags-to-riches story, the triumph of sheer willpower over adversity. The key element of a challenge plot is that the obstacles seem daunting to the protagonist. Jared slimming down to 180 pounds is a challenge plot. Jared's 210-pound neighbor shaving an inch off his waistline is not. We've all got a huge mental inventory of challenge plot stories. The American hockey team beating the heavily favored Russians in the 1980 Olympics. The Alamo. Horatio Alger tales. The American Revolution. Seabiscuit. The Star Wars movies. Lance Armstrong. Rosa Parks. Challenge plots are inspiring even when they're much less dramatic and historical than these examples. The Rose Blumkin story doesn't involve a famous character. Challenge plots are inspiring in a defined way. They inspire us by appealing to our perseverance and courage. They make us want to work harder, take on new challenges, overcome obstacles. Somehow, after you've heard about Rose Blumkin postponing her 100th birthday party until an evening when her store was closed, it's easier to clean out your garage. Challenge plots inspire us to act. The connection plot. Today, the phrase Good Samaritan refers to someone who voluntarily helps others in times of distress. The original story of the Good Samaritan from the Bible is certainly consistent with this definition, but it's even more profound. The story begins with a lawyer who approached Jesus with a question about how to get to heaven. The lawyer was more interested in testing Jesus than in learning from him. When Jesus asked the lawyer what he thought the answer was, the lawyer gave a reply that included the notion, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." Jesus accepted the lawyer's answer. Then the lawyer, perhaps wanting to limit the number of people he's on the hook to love, says, "And who is my neighbor?" In response, Jesus told a story. A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he fell into the hands of robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey, took him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 silver coins and gave them to the innkeeper. "Look after him," he said, "and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have." Which of these 3 do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers? The lawyer replied, "The one who had mercy on him." Jesus told him, "Go and do likewise." What's missing from this tale for modern-day readers is a bit of context. The Samaritan in the story was not simply a nice guy. He was a nice guy crossing a huge social gulf in helping the wounded man. At the time, there was tremendous hostility between Samaritans and Jews, all the other main characters in the story. A modern-day analogy to the outcast status of the Samaritan might be an atheist biker gang member. The lesson of the story is clear. Good neighbors show mercy and compassion, and not just to people in their own group. This is what a connection plot is all about. It's a story about people who develop a relationship that bridges a gap, racial, class, ethnic, religious, demographic, or otherwise. The connection plot doesn't have to deal with life and death stakes, as does the Good Samaritan. The connection can be as trivial as a bottle of a Coke, as in the famous Mean Joe Green commercial. A scrawny young white fan encounters a towering famous black athlete. A bottle of Coke links them. It ain't the Good Samaritan, but it's clearly a connection plot. Connection plots are also fabulous for romance stories. Think of Romeo and Juliet, or the top-grossing film of all time, Titanic. All connection plots inspire us in social ways. They make us want to help others, be more tolerant of others, work with others, love others. The connection plot is the most common kind of plot found in the Chicken Soup series. Where challenge plots involve overcoming challenges, connection plots are about our relationships with other people. If you're telling a story at the company Christmas party, it's probably best to use the connection plot. If you're telling a story at the kickoff party for a new project, go with the challenge plot. The creativity plot. The third major type of inspirational story is the creativity plot. The prototype might be the story of the apple that falls on Newton's head, inspiring his theory of gravity. The creativity plot involves someone making a mental breakthrough, solving a long-standing puzzle, or attacking a problem in an innovative way. It's the MacGyver plot. Ingersoll Rand is a giant company that makes non-sexy products such as industrial grinders, used in auto shops to sand down auto bodies. Historically, Ingersoll Rand had been slow at bringing new products to market. One employee, frustrated by the average 4-year product life cycle, said, "It was taking us longer to introduce a new product than it took our nation to fight World War II." Ingersoll Rand decided to do something about the slow development cycle. The company created a project team whose goal was to produce a new grinder in a year, 1/4 the usual time. Standard theories of organizational culture would have predicted a slim chance of success. The Grindr team, however, did a lot of things right, including the use of stories to emphasize the group's new attitude and culture. One story, for instance, involved a critical decision about whether to build the new Grindr's casing out of plastic or metal. Plastic would be more comfortable for the customer, but would it hold up as well as metal? The traditional Ingersoll Rand method of solving this problem would have been to conduct protracted, careful studies of the tensile and compression properties of both materials. But this was the Grindr team. They were supposed to act quickly. A few members of the team cooked up a less formal testing procedure. While on an off-site customer visit, the team members tied a sample of each material to the back bumper of their rental car, then drove around the parking lot with the materials dragging behind. They kept this up until the police came and told them to knock it off. The verdict was that the new plastic composite held up just as well as the traditional metal. Decision made. In the history of the Grindr team, this story has become known as the drag test. The drag test is a creativity plot that reinforced the team's new culture. The drag test implied, we still need to get the right data to make decisions. We just need to do it a lot quicker. The famous explorer, Ernest Shackleton, faced such enormous odds in his explorations, obviously a classic challenge plot, that unity among his men was mission critical. A mutiny could leave everyone dead. Shackleton came up with a creative solution for dealing with the whiny, complaining types. He assigned them to sleep in his own tent. When people separated into groups to work on chores, he grouped the complainers with him. Through his constant presence, he minimized their negative influence. Creativity plots make us want to do something different, to be creative, to experiment with new approaches. The goal of reviewing these plots is not to help us invent stories. Unless you write fiction or advertisements, that won't help much. The goal here is to learn how to spot the stories that have potential. When the Jared article hits our desk, we want to spot the crucial elements immediately. Guy faces huge obstacles and overcomes them. It's a challenge plot. Challenge plots inspire people to take on challenges and work harder. If that feeling is consistent with the goal you want to achieve, run with the story. Don't tack it on the bulletin board. If you're running the Grindr team and you're trying to reinvent the company culture, then you need to be on the lookout for creativity plots. When you hear that some of your men dragged metal around a parking lot, you've found something. Know what you're looking for. You don't need to make stuff up. You don't need to exaggerate or be as melodramatic as the chicken soup tales. The drag test isn't melodramatic. You just need to recognize when life is giving you a gift. Stories at the World Bank. In 1996, Stephen Denning was working for the World Bank, the international institution that lends money to developing countries for infrastructure projects such as building schools, roads, and water treatment facilities. At the time, he managed the bank's work in Africa, the third largest area of the bank, and seemed to be on a fast track to the top of the organization. Then, one of his two main mentors retired and the second left. Shortly thereafter, he was asked to step down from his Africa position and look into the issue of information. His superiors asked him to explore the area of knowledge management. Denning said, "Now, this was a bank which cared about flows of money, not information." The new assignment was the equivalent of being sent to corporate Siberia. The task was not just organizationally unattractive, it was daunting. The World Bank knew a lot about how to achieve results in developing nations, but that information was scattered about the organization. The World Bank conducted projects in dozens of countries all over the world, and while there was a central bureaucracy, much of the operational know-how was naturally at the local level. Each project was, in a sense, its own universe. A water treatment guru in Zambia might have figured out a great way to handle local political negotiations, but he was unlikely to have the opportunity to share it with a highway construction guru in Bangladesh. Neither manager would know the other existed unless they happened to be in the same circle of friends or former colleagues. A month after accepting his assignment, Denning had lunch with a colleague who had just returned from Zambia. This colleague was working on a project to improve health care, particularly for mothers and children. While he was in Zambia, he had met a health care worker in Kamana, a small town 360 miles from Zambia's capital, who was struggling to fight malaria in the community and was trying to find information on how to combat the disease. The worker had found a way to log on to the Internet and had discovered the answers he needed on the website of the Centers for Disease Control, CDC, in Atlanta. Keep in mind that this was in 1996, when the Internet would not have been the obvious first stop for someone in search of information, especially in Africa. Denning says that he didn't give the story much thought at the time. It was just an interesting anecdote about the resourcefulness of a colleague. Later, it dawned on him that the Zambia story was a perfect example of the power of knowledge management. Someone in charge of a vital operation needed information. He went looking for it, found it, and as a result, was able to act more effectively. That's the vision of knowledge management, except that the healthcare worker shouldn't have been forced to conduct a trial-and-error search, ending at the CDC's website to get the right information. He should have been able to tap the knowledge of the World Bank. Denning began to incorporate the story into conversations with colleagues, stressing why the World Bank ought to make knowledge management a serious priority. Weeks later, he had an opportunity to speak to a committee of senior management. He'd have only 10 to 12 minutes on the agenda. In that time, he'd have to introduce a new organizational strategy and win the group's endorsement. A tall order. First, Denning set up the problem. The difficulties that the World Bank had experienced in pooling its knowledge and the sorry state of its information systems. Then, rather than doing what most people would have done, i.e., rehashing the discipline of knowledge management and quoting some authorities about the importance of knowledge management for the 21st century, Denning did something different. He told the Zambia story. Immediately after the presentation, two executives raced up to Denning and began to bombard him with all the things he should be doing to get the program off the ground. Denning thought, "This is a very strange conversation. Up till 10 minutes ago, these people weren't willing to give me the time of day, and now I'm not doing enough to implement their idea. This is horrible. They've stolen my idea." And then he had a happier thought. "How wonderful. They've stolen my idea. It's become their idea." A few years later, after Denning had left the World Bank, he devoted himself to spreading the lessons he'd learned about storytelling. In 2001, he wrote a very insightful book called The Springboard. Denning defines a springboard story as a story that lets people see how an existing problem might change. Springboard stories tell people about possibilities. One major advantage of springboard stories is that they combat skepticism and create buy-in. Denning says that the idea of telling stories initially violated his intuition. He had always believed in the value of being direct, and he worried that stories were too ambiguous, too peripheral, too anecdotal. He thought, "Why not spell out the message directly? Why go to the trouble and difficulty of trying to elicit the listener's thinking indirectly, when it would be so much simpler if I came straight out in an abstract directive? Why not hit the listeners between the eyes?" The problem is that when you hit listeners between the eyes, they respond by fighting back. The way you deliver a message to them is a cue to how they should react. If you make an argument, you're implicitly asking them to evaluate your argument, judge it, debate it, criticize it, and then argue back, at least in their minds. But with a story, Denning argues, you engage the audience. You are involving people with the idea, asking them to participate with you. Denning talks about engaging the little voice inside the head, the voice that would normally debate the speaker's points. The conventional view of communication is to ignore the little voice inside the head and hope it stays quiet and that the message will somehow get through, Denning says. But he has a different recommendation. Don't ignore the little voice. Instead, work in harmony with it. Engage.